I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's the former Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. Currently, he's the Executive Director of Public Lands Media. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 38 books on environmental issues in natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Thrillcraft, Energy, and most recently, Protecting the Wild. So before we actually start the interview today, which is about wolverines, I just wanted to not only thank you for all your work over the decades, but also thank you for holding true to the spirit of the environmentalism that at least I grew up with, which is an environmentalism that centers wild nature and wild beings as opposed to attempting to sustain this destructive economy. So as well as doing your work for the wild, I really appreciate the work that you have done of carrying the torch through difficult times of true environmentalism as opposed to sort of the neo-environmentalism that so much has become.
Well, thanks. That's quite a compliment. I appreciate it.
Well, and we should do an interview sometime about neo-environmentalism, which I think is just dreadful.
I have an interesting story to tell for that, actually. So whenever we get around to it, that would be I can tell this story. I've been thinking about it as an essay beginning, actually, on that topic. So, yeah.
Okay, great. In any case, today we're going to talk about wolverines. So who are wolverines? What roles do they play in their community? What's their traditional range? Were they once common? Are they now common? Just everything you want to say about wolverines.
All right. Well, I'll start. They're in the weasel family, like marten, mink, otters are all in the weasel family. And the wolverine is one of the larger land animals in the weasel family. In other words, you know, the sea otters are bigger animals, but basically they're one of the larger of the weasel family. But they're still not that big, about the size of a small bear cub. And they are generally found in places that have continuous snow cover a lot of the year. And I'll probably a little later explain why that is. But they're really associated with areas that have a lot of snow. So in the lower 48 states, we're talking about higher mountain ranges. And then when you get up further north, like in northern Canada, where it's just flat tundra in a lot of the areas, they do well there too, because they just are adapted to snow. And a number of the ways that their adaption to snow is that they have very large paws for the size of their body, so they can, you know, travel on top of snow without falling in. And they are also their fur is such that snow doesn't stick to it, and that has made them a popular target for the fringe on people's jackets, hoods, so that when in cold climates, when you breathe out, you don't get frost gathering on the edge of your hood, you know. So particularly indigenous people for a long time used to trap wolverine for the trim on their hoods. And the other thing about wolverine is that they're pretty they have amazing jaws. I guess that's the only way to describe it. And that has to do with what they eat, which is they tend to rely on carrion a lot. In other words, dead animals that they find, and being able to chew through the skin and the muscle and the bones, they have to have a really strong jaw muscles to do that. And I have a kind of an interesting story. One of the first times I ever heard anything about wolverine, I attended a lecture when I was an undergraduate in wildlife at the University of Montana. And the very first study that had been done on wolverine, the researchers were giving a talk. And they had set up traps up by Glacier Park to try to catch wolverine. And they didn't really know much about how to go about catching a wolverine. So they were using bear traps that are used in the summertime to move bears that are gotten into campgrounds or whatever. And these are basically a tube of metal, like you would use for a stream, you know, to allow the water to go downstream under a road, a culvert kind of thing. And then with a fencing, like you have chain link fencing, like you would have in somebody's yard or whatever, as the cover for the trap door. And so they put this out with some dead meat in it, and they actually did get a wolverine caught in it. The problem was is they weren't checking their trap every day, and when they got to the trap, they found that the wolverine had chewed its way out of the chain link fencing. So that gives you some idea of the kind of jaws that these animals have. And so one of the lessons they learn is they have to check the trap very frequently. Otherwise, the wolverine might try to get out. And now a lot of the traps that they use for trapping wolverine are made out of logs, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5 inches thick. And again, you have to, check them frequently, but that's quite a job for them to chew their way out of something like that. So they have these strong jaws, and they travel around great distances looking for dead animals in the high country. And in the lower 48 states or up on the tundra, more flat, but they travel great distances, and the distances they travel are astounding. Again, at this lecture, nobody knew much about wolverine, but they had finally caught one, and they radio collared it near Glacier, and it traveled down to Lincoln, Montana, which was about 150 miles south, and then back up to Glacier all in 1 week. So 300 miles through rugged mountains in the process of 1 week. And some wolverine have been documented traveling even further. For example, there was a wolverine that was discovered near Lake Tahoe that they were able to get a hair sample and found that from the DNA analysis that it was related to wolverine from Idaho. And another wolverine from Grand Teton National Park found its way down to Colorado. So the point being is that part of their strategy for surviving is to travel great distances. And they, as a result, their density in any one area is very small, or the population is small. And the density is not very high. And this is one of the things that has irritated me about some of the states in the past. For example, Montana maintained a trapping season for wolverine. I don't believe they have it now, but at one point they would. And their argument was, well, we're still seeing tracks of wolverine in various places. So that must mean there's a lot of them. In fact, it didn't mean there was a lot of them. It was just you can have one wolverine, you know, travel through many mountain ranges and leave tracks behind in the normal travel that they do. And so give you a false sense of security, you might say, in that there might be more wolverine around than really exists. And the wolverine have been petitioned for listing under the Endangered Species Act. And the logic behind that is that they are so dependent on snow cover with climate change, their habitat is shrinking in at least the lower 48 states. And it's estimated that there's no more than about 300 wolverine south of Canada in the states of along the northern border. So the density, or the greatest density of wolverine, are found in Montana, Idaho, and there are a few in the Cascades of the North Cascades of Washington. There's like two or three have been documented in eastern Oregon near the Idaho border, near Hell's Canyon, and then, you know, a few in Wyoming, mostly centered around the Tetons and Yellowstone. But the really heart of the Wolverine terrain is like up around Glacier Park in the lower 48 states, that is. And there may be as many as 30 Wolverine living in Glacier Park alone, which, you know, it's Glacier Park's over 1 million acres. So that's still not very many animals. And it's funny, I've been lucky to see actual Wolverine in the wild, even as rare as they are. I was on the Alaska Peninsula and fishing actually on this river in the southern part of the Alaska Peninsula, and I saw what I thought was a grizzly bear cub loping along on the other side of the riverbank from me. And but then as I looked at it, I'm like, no, that's not a bear cub, and it was a Wolverine that I saw. And, you know, I didn't get a long look at it because it disappeared, but it had a kind of a unique way of loping that made it different from like a bear. And another time I saw a Wolverine was in Glacier Park in the wintertime. I was skiing there one March and had a Wolverine run along the edge of a lake, snow-covered lake, about, you know, half a mile away. So I still wasn't close to it. And the third encounter, I call it encounter, where the Wolverine was finding Wolverine tracks on the Idaho-Montana border in what's known as the Great Burn in one winter while on a ski trip there. So I've had a few close encounters with an animal that's pretty rare. So it's always been exciting to me to have those encounters. And the thing about Wolverine that's really amazing is and has been documented since they've been able to radio collar some more of these animals is they will go places that most animals won't. There's a very good book, if anybody's really interested in learning about Wolverine, called The Wolverine Way by Doug Chadwick, who's a frequent contributor to National Geographic. But Doug has helped with studies in Glacier, and one Wolverine they radio collared went straight up Mount Cleveland, you know, on this super, super steep angle and basically climbed over the mountain and continued on its way. I mean, on slopes that even a mountain goat would have a trouble with. And so they're adapted to doing these sort of long travel with this loping gait that is pretty efficient. It doesn't take a lot of energy to do. And, they are well known for traveling, like I said, great distances trying to find dead animals. Now, that they will kill animals alive. There's a lot of sort of mythology about how ferocious they are, you know, that, oh, they'll kill a caribou or they'll kill an elk or something like that, which I have no doubt that probably maybe has happened occasionally when an animal like a caribou or an elk is trapped in deep snow or really sick. But it would not be that unusual for a Wolverine to try to take down, say, a deer. And they certainly go after any weakened animals that they come upon, and as well as things like snowshoe rabbits and grouse and smaller prey like that. So how's that so far?
Oh, that's great. And I have a ton of questions. One of them
all
is
right. Let's go with question.
Is Michigan is known as the Wolverine State, and I know that the last one they saw before, I don't know, 10 years ago was like 100 years ago or a long time ago, and then they saw one 10, 15 years ago, 5 years ago, a while ago, and then I don't know if they killed it or if it disappeared, but the point is that you've talked about the West. Were Wolverines, you talk about snow, were Wolverines once in... Obviously, they were in Michigan. Were they in Maine? Are they still in the eastern part of Canada, too?
Yes, they were found in Maine. They were found in Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, those northern states up near the Canadian border, but did disappear due to they're very vulnerable to trapping, and especially because of their low numbers. And, you know, they were pretty much wiped out in those states. And even in the Western states, like years ago when I was studying wildlife biology, one of the things we learned, even in Montana, Wolverine were practically trapped out, particularly during the 1930s, during the the stock market crash that a lot of people took to trapping in rural parts of the West, and Wolverine brought in a pretty good price. So people were out trapping them, and they were eliminated from most of Idaho and Montana and Wyoming, and they only were sustained, it is theorized, in Glacier Park, because every place else they were getting trapped, which again points to the value of places like national parks where there no exploitation is allowed. But then, once they sort of got to low numbers and people weren't trapping as much because they didn't need the money quite as badly, then the wolverine have been able to recover to some degree across places like Montana and Idaho and Wyoming due to lower trapping pressure. And now I don't know what the status is for Montana. I know they used to have a season where their logic was they say, well, we're only going to allow, I think it was one or two wolverine, and then they would close the trapping season. The problem with that logic is, and I should step back and say, in all the other states, they closed trapping for wolverine, Wyoming, Idaho, Washington, etc. But in Montana said, we'll close it after one or two wolverine are trapped. The problem with that is that, for example, if they were to trap a female in the winter, that female may be ready to give birth or may already have pups. I think they're called pups, wolverine pups. The young would then be left without any care and would die. So you trap one wolverine, you might take out one or two more just because they die without their mother to care for them. And even if you take out a male, it's been found recently that even the male wolverine will help raise the young on occasions. And so again, you could have that loss of that male might affect the reproduction. So the idea that, okay, we're going to close the season after one or two animals are trapped, well, that might be all the animals in an entire mountain range, for example. And you don't know when that mountain range would get recolonized with a breeding population. I mean, their density is so low, there may only be five or six animals in a mountain range, and a diligent trapper might take all the animals in that range, the reproduction factor, reproductive factor for that range, by trapping a female with and the young dying as a result. So anyway, I can't remember what the status is for Montana right now, but that was one of the challenges trying to get, and one of the reasons for getting it listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act, because it would close the season for trapping in Montana as well.
So you've mentioned several times that they have a very low population density, and we've all heard that, I mean, wolverines have this reputation for being, let's just say, testy.
Yes.
And yet the male will, you've just said that the male will possibly help raise the pups. So are they solitary creatures? Do they, if there's enough food present, can they, like, we've all seen at least photos, and you may have seen this in real life, and I've seen it in real life, where when there's a large food base, bears will not be solitary, but can actually hang out as a larger group as they, as you've mentioned in interviews, all eat a whale together. So if there's a strong prey base, can they be social? And in general, what are their social relations? Like, how long do the pups stay with the mother? Maybe mother-father pair? Just tell me about their society, or their social or non-social relationships.
Well, actually, this is relatively new insights to wolverine, because exactly as you said, they were for a long time thought to be very solitary. And now they're finding they do spend time together, that males will stay associated with females. Now, by the way, males will sometimes have two or three females in their territory. That's one of the reasons why they wander so much. But they will still, I don't know if you know the story of Seldon Sean Smith, the Monkey Wrench Gang, but Seldon Sean Smith had was a Mormon, and he had two or three wives scattered around southern Utah, and he'd just show up for a week at each one. So the Wolverine males are somewhat like that. And but they do have, help to care for the young. There's pictures now of Wolverine adults playing with the young ones, and just that they're much more social than was ever thought in the past. And they, as a result, again, you have to protect the entire population. And this old idea from hunting and so forth, oh, well, it's okay to take the males. There's no, first of all, trapping, there's no way to distinguish whether you're going to catch a male or not. The theory being, since one male can impregnate numerous females, that if you take a male now and again, it's not a big deal. But the fact is that it could upset the whole social network. And usually you have, just like in some other animals, there'll be a dominant male that'll have a territory with several females. And so it is thought that some of these animals that have wandered long distance, like the Wolverine that went from Idaho over to Lake Tahoe area, was probably a male searching for a mate. And so that's kind of what they do. They wander around trying to find a mate at some distance. And that's one of the hopes, that another reason why trapping, as Montana was doing, isn't good. Because if you are going to expand the range of Wolverine, most of those males aren't going to find a mate, but a few of them will. And then you might get a new population established in a mountain range or an area that hadn't had Wolverine in the past.
Well, this actually raises another question I was going to ask, is with such a large range, how do they find a mate? And I just want to take this opportunity before you answer that question to talk about anglerfish for a second, just because they're so amazing. Anglerfish, deep sea creatures, the chance of meeting any fish is almost nil. And the males are really tiny. And basically, they could never meet a female at the right time. So in that case, if the male finds a female, he attaches to her body, dissolves himself until only his testes remain, and then she's got a source of sperm. Obviously, wolverines don't do that, but I just love telling that story. So back to wolverines.
Well, actually, yeah, there is something like that that goes on with wolverine. In that, all the weasel family has what's called delay implantation. So they'll mate, say, in the fall or whenever they can find each other, and the embryos don't develop for a time, and then until the right time in the spring. And so that is one of their survival mechanisms, actually, is because it probably related to the low density, that if they can find each other, they may delay the birth of the young. For a time. The other thing is that they have a very strong scent. In fact, people that handle wolverines say it's pretty hard to take the scent of the wolverine. And all the mustelids, or the weasel family, have glands that have a strong odor. Skunk are. They are in the weasel family. They're the example of an animal that has really developed the scent part as a defense mechanism. But nevertheless, they all have pretty strong scent. So the other thing is, of course, they leave their scent sign around as they're traveling, including the females, and that helps the males eventually locate the females. And so that's how they kind of find each other, even though they're dispersed over very large areas.
And do the females have a home territory that they will defend against other females, or can they coexist in the same area?
My understanding is that they can coexist to a degree. Usually it's a related. In other words, like if a female has a daughter, she will tolerate her daughter overlapping in the same area. The males are the ones that don't tolerate other males, mostly. So the young males have to go out and find a new place to live if they can, in order to not be harassed by the older males.
So you talked early on about how much they are evolved for snow, but you've also mentioned that they traveled across Wyoming and they traveled down to Lake Tahoe. And are they, did they only travel in the winter? Because, you know, I grew up in Colorado and drove through Wyoming a bazillion times, and it can get pretty hot. And so,
yeah,
would they what? Only travel in the winter, or can they do okay if they have to travel from Idaho down to Lake Tahoe?
Well, my understanding is that, I'll have to answer this by saying I'm not sure what the answer is to your question. I'm presuming that they travel in the winter months, when even the lower elevations are snow covered or at least cold. And part of the reason they have this demand for snow cover is two things. One, they're designed to travel, like I said, with their large paws, they can travel over snow more efficiently than they can over land that doesn't have snow, you know, having to climb over rocks and logs and everything else. The other thing about snow cover is, particularly for the females, they den in snow, and they dig a den in the snow, and it has to be in a place when they give birth that it isn't going to melt away, it isn't going to, you know, leak water in to the den. So they need places that stay cold and are the snow, it tends to be relatively deep. And the other reason for snow cover is that when they do find a dead animal or whatever, they will cover it up, and, you know, it will basically use the snow as a freezer so that they can come back and eat more of that animal that they found. They're not like wolves who will carry the food, you know, long distances back. So they'll have to travel, and they find where they have left the animal and then come back. And the fact that if it's under snow or frozen, it'll still be good for them to consume. So I don't know that they wouldn't travel across something like, the sagebrush basins of Wyoming in the summertime, or like the one that went from Idaho to Lake Tahoe across Nevada. But my guess would be it would be done in the wintertime. And if it were done in the summer, at least would probably at night be the time that they would travel. And the part of the reason is they have just such a heavy coat. They're designed to, you know, tolerate cold, and they don't do well when it gets real warm.
So the next question has to do with their jaws that you and I have discussed before. A question, okay, this started because I live in a forest, and I throw lots of, like, I love feeding the forest by throwing vegetable scraps or just whatever food scraps in the forest, and they usually disappear. And I had short ribs one day 15 years ago, and I cleaned off the ribs, and then I was walking through the forest, and I threw them out. And I also absolutely love, I have this intense, I really am fascinated by decay. So I'll throw out vegetable matter, and then I love watching it slowly get eaten by slugs or slowly fungus or whoever eats it over the next year. And the cool, interesting thing is that even though there are bears here and mountain lions and everybody else, there are some short ribs I threw out 15 years ago that have not been eaten by anybody. And so that really started me thinking, and you and I have had this discussion before, it started me thinking, who eats really big bones like buffalo femurs? And you had said, when I brought that up, this was years ago, and I don't expect you to remember it. You had said that you had seen grizzlies eating whales, and you did not see the grizzlies breaking the big bones of the whales. So we were then sort of having a free form, you know, sort of brainstorm on maybe, I mean, when you have 60 million buffalo on the plains, and if they live for 10 years, say, I know they live for 20, but we'll call it 10, then you're going to have 6 million dead buffalo every year, which means you're going to have 12 million buffalo femurs every year on the plains. And who eats those? And we weren't thinking it was grizzly bears, but I know we've moved into the plains here, which is a different place. But the point of all this is, can wolverines break the biggest bones of the biggest animals?
Well, I don't know the answer for sure to that, but they certainly can break the bones of caribou and elk and so forth. And their jaws are really designed for that kind of bone crushing kind of activity. And so I would suspect they'd be able to handle a bison too. And, you know, to be honest about it, probably in the old days when bison were abundant on the plains, particularly the northern plains, you know, the wolverine probably feasted on them at least in the winter months. You know, they could travel out of the mountains and then go up into the mountains for breeding purposes, you know, to raise the young and so forth. But during the winter months, you know, it's pretty cold on the northern plains and Montana and North Dakota and those places. And I would not have been surprised that wolverine would have been seen once in a while. Although, I'll tell you the truth, you know, you're having me think about this. I read all kinds of early trapper journals and military expeditions, you know, and all the famous guys like John Fremont and others that traveled, and Zevenham Pike and others who took careful notes. And I just can't remember ever once any of them saying they saw a wolverine on the plane. So, but, you know, again, it could be that I read that somewhere and I just didn't note it at the time. But
the extraordinary,
they certainly weren't abundant.
The larger issue that it raises, and then we'll go back to wolverines in a second, is I'm just so fascinated by how they're really, how there is, at the, I wonder and have awe at nature, the way that everybody ends up food for somebody. And so I just love those processes of finding out and asking again. You know, we know that when a buffalo dies, that you know, the ravens are going to eat this part, and the wolves are going to come, and the foxes will come when they're at some stage, and the carrion beetles will come, and the flies will come. And I've always just then wondered, you know, what happens to the bones, because they're going to be, and this is a problem all over the world. I know that in some parts of the world, some of the bones are eaten by certain species of vulture, who will lift them up and fly with them and then drop them onto rocks to break them. And other places, I think, go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's no doubt that wolves were very good at breaking bones. You know, they have very strong jaw muscles. And if you look at the attachment for the jaw muscles on a wolf compared to a domestic dog, the attachment places are much larger because they have much larger muscles in their jaws. And of course, grizzlies could do the same thing as far as breaking bones. So I think that at least those two species could at times, you know, break through the bones. And all this has to do with how abundant food is at any one time. In other words, you know, if there's a lot of dead bison around, you don't bother breaking the bones because you got plenty to eat. And when you're starving, you break the bones. And in fact, the Indians did the same thing. You know, and some of the fur trappers and others, when they had limited food, they would just take the bones and put them in a pot and boil it and try to crack the marrow out of it. And that soup might be all they had to eat for days at a time. So
let's go back to wolverines. And thank you for that. Thank you for that little digression. So how long do they live and how many babies do they have? Go ahead.
Well, okay. Well, 2 to 3 babies is about the norm. I don't know if they get up to 4, but 2 or 3 is not unusual. And the age, you know, I'm really not sure of how long they live, to tell you the truth. That's a good question for me to look up. But, you know, they're a smaller animal, so it would probably be unusual for them to live more than, you know, 10 years at most. You know, for given the harshness of the environment and all the things they have to go through, you know, who knows how long they'd live in a zoo, but out in the wild, you know, their lives are considerably shorter.
And are the populations, let's leave off global warming for a second. You said that with less trapping, their populations have recovered. So if we let's wave a magic wand for a second and make it so global warming doesn't happen. Do you think that they would be doing okay? Are they okay for habitat, or are they like everybody else having their habitat just hammered? Again, ignoring global warming.
Well, interesting, because that made me think of another problem that they're having, which is disturbance in the winter because of winter recreation. More, you know, everything from snowmobiles to backcountry skiers to, you know, ski areas. You know, particularly, I would say probably snowmobiles are the worst problem because they can travel far and they and they're getting their equipment is getting better and better so that a snowmobile today can travel in snow that's lighter powder and they can go faster and then go greater distances than they could even 20 or 30 years ago. And particularly the snowmobile makes a difference for two reasons. One, to the degree that there is trapping happening like up in Canada and Alaska, the snowmobile allows the trappers to cover great distances. And so they're still trapping up in places like Alaska and Canada. But the other thing is just the disturbance, particularly of females in their den. There's some evidence to suggest, that if there's a lot of human activity, the wolverine will move out of that area. So as we're getting increasing amounts of people, you know, traveling in higher elevation areas in the winter months, we're shrinking that habitat for the wolverine. And then, even though you don't want to talk about climate change, you throw in climate change where the amount, the length of this, the snow remains in the high country and the areas where snow cover remains is shrinking. So the people that are recreating on snow are also getting into a, you know, a shrinking, you might say, habitat for them. So you're bringing more human presence into snow-covered terrain and higher mountain areas, and you're reducing the amount of that habitat, and so the conflicts are potentially growing. I'm not sure that there's any strong evidence yet, given how rare wolverine are, that that this is a problem, but it, you could certainly see where it would be a growing problem in areas where the snow recreation is increasing in these higher elevation places.
Just to be clear, it wasn't that I didn't want to talk about global warming. It's that I wanted to separate the issues, and you did both. That's great. I was just going to do one then the other. There's another issue. Oh, okay. Before we talk about the status of the attempts to list, there's another thing I want to bring up, which I think is really kind of interesting, which is that in some European languages, the wolverine, okay, in English, wolverine basically means little wolf, and that, you know, makes sense. And in some countries, especially Scandinavian countries, the name for wolverine has a root in like gluttonous badger or gluttonous. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if you have any insight into that. I mean, are they known for eating prodigious quantities of food at one time? Do they gorge and then not eat for 2 weeks? Is that their standard thing, or is this just a non-issue?
You know, I really don't. I know that the Latin name is gulo gulo, which might, you know, have some derivative gluttons. I really don't know what the you know, the origins of that is. Whether, you know, it would seem that given the large distances they have to travel and the infrequency of encountering food, that you know, maybe that is the way it is. They eat a whole lot. You know, at one time, wolves are like that too. You know, they'll eat a ton of food, and then if they don't have anything, they might go without eating anything for a week or more. So it could be the same thing.
You know, another
with the wolverine.
Something else that just occurs to me, I'm making this up as I go, is it could be also, mm-hmm, because they're so fierce in defending their I mean, they have the reputation, at least, for being fierce. So it could be that if somebody sees them at a dead caribou, and they're chasing away, and they may even be chasing away much bigger creatures, then maybe they would get that reputation for just being, you know, this is mine and I'm going to keep it, which if you're hungry, I can see why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk. Go ahead.
Yeah. Go ahead. No, go ahead. What's your next
question? Okay, so the next question is, how long have the attempts been being made to get them listed, and what is the status?
You know, I'm not 100% sure when the first attempt had, but I know that there was a attempt started in 2013. And the latest is just this last October, the Fish and Wildlife Service again declined to list the wolverine for several reasons. One, they said that the dire conditions due to global warming haven't yet hit to any great extent in the high country where wolverine are found for the most part. And the second reason is they say that they're part of the population that's found up in Canada all the way to Alaska, where, you know, wolverine overall, that terrain, their numbers are still at least seemingly stable. So so they denied listing again just this last year. And, you know, the argument given against that is that, you know, you just because and you may or may not know, the Fish and Wildlife Service has the ability to set aside what's called a distinct population segment for any of the animals. In other words, if you can show that, say, the wolverine in the lower 48 states are not genetically connected all the time to the populations up in Canada, then you can separately list them, even though there may be a lot of wolverine in Canada. So anyway, that's sort of the nuance of the conversation, is trying to show that the populations in the lower 48 states don't have enough genetic connection with animals up in Canada, and that because of all these other factors, increasing recreation, because of the snowpack is declining, because of they're just low population in the lower 48 states to begin with, you have problems of genetic inbreeding, especially because one male might breed two or three females. Okay, so if you're talking about, so there's 300 animals in the lower 48 states, okay, and some of those are young, they're not breeding. Let's say they're out of the 300, I'm just going to make up a number, 200 of them are adults, and of that adults, maybe only half of the males, again, I'm making this up, but half of the males breed the females that are of the other 100 that are out there, because the younger males don't do the breeding. So you have this base of genetic breeding that could be inbreeding, because you have maybe 50 males doing all the breeding in the lower 48 states. So you get the idea. These are just hypothetical numbers, but just because of their biology and their limited population, you could have some genetic bottlenecks happening as a result, especially, and this is the other part of it, is as more and more development happens up in Canada along the borders and stuff. You know, you've got the Highway 3, which is just north of the U.S. border, that makes it hard for animals to traverse. It's a very busy highway north and south. And then you've got Highway 1 in Canada, which is the Trans-Canadian Highway, also crossing, you know, through Banff and across into Yoho National Park and on the other side. So anyway, the point being, there's a lot of road traffic on that part of Canada, because almost all the east-west traffic in Canada is just on a few highways. And so, you know, wolverine have to run a gauntlet if they're going to go north and south of that. And so that becomes a barrier to genetic interaction with wolverine down here in the lower 48 states. You know, that along with the fact that the limited breeding population is so small to begin with, it raises concerns. But right now, the Fish and Wildlife Service has denied listing. So,
well, you raise another really important point. In previous interviews, when we talked about forests and how clear-cutting forests in response to some sort of disease is a terrible idea, and there are many reasons for that, one of which it's really stupid. But another that you've said explicitly is that you may be actually cutting some of the trees who have genetic who have resistance to that disease, and if you clear cut them, then they're gone, and they could be right. The trees who survive. And it's the same thing right. When you have any small population like this, that if some disease hits at some point, even though those other males aren't actually breeding and passing on their genes, they could be the ones that hold some sort of resistance. And then if the breeding males die, then you have somebody step into their place. But if they've been trapped, then you've taken out the ones who have that resistance. And I'm thinking about this in part because there is a disease that is spreading through California right now for bears that is it's a neurological disease that's causing them to do strange behaviors. And it's the same, you know, I think a lot about, you know, there is generally one bear will impregnate male bear will impregnate several females, and all the other yearlings, I mean, not yearlings, but all the other males are essentially evolutionary dead ends, except for the fact that, but they're not dead ends at all. They're a reserve pool for resilience in case a disease comes through. And it seems the exact same thing here, except even more so because there's only 300 of them.
Right, exactly. That is always the problem with small populations. And you remember, this is 300 spread over Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, and some into Washington, and a little population in Oregon. Where, I mean, that's a huge area for 300 animals to be found on. And so again, the limited population, along with the great distance that the habitat or occupied habitat is covers, really, really does put them at risk because of genetic issues. And the other part of it, of course, is the habitat shrinking. So the habitat available, you know, maybe right now isn't that different, but the fear is by 2100 or 2100, that a lot of the places that they're found today will no longer be suitable to them. So only the really highest mountains will be able to sustain the wolverine that have long-term snow cover. And so you're going to see the population shrink anyway. So part of this is like, do we wait until, you know, this is the problem with the Endangered Species Act in general, is that the only way you get a species listed is when they're already so low that the problems they have with genetics, with loss of habitat and so forth, recovery is very difficult to bring about. And and unfortunately, that's just the way the act works. What we need is something that is preventative, not wait until animals are on the verge of extinction. But when you can see that the conditions are changing to the point where they will be you know, on the verge of extinction, you ought to be able to do something soon, but before that. But right now, that's not the way the act works.
I completely agree with you. So we're running short on time. And is there anything else you've wanted to say about wolverines that I haven't given you opportunity? Either any stories, any anecdotes, anything?
Let me see. Think about that. You know, like a lot of this stuff, they're doing studies up in Alaska about whether trapping, which still happens up there, is having an impact on wolverine. And the wolverine there travel even greater distances because food is so scarce. It's one of those things where it just seems criminal in my mind that trapping is, you know, trapping's pretty barbaric in the first place, but it's particularly criminal with animals as rare to begin with as a wolverine should be, any trapping should be allowed. And it's, you know, it's just for something that isn't really necessary. We don't need to have the wolverine fur on people's jackets and we can find other ways to prevent frost from accumulating than having wolverine fur there. So it to me, it's a shame that that trapping happens in Alaska and Canada still. And that would, if that were to be terminated up there, we might actually see more wolverine expanding the range in the lower 48 states. But right now, it's not possible.
Well, thank you, as always, for, for your great work in the world. And thank you for teaching us today about wolverines. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werthner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.